A new redistricting plan now puts Juneau Representative Kathy Munoz against Haines Representative Bill Thomas and separates downtown Juneau and Petersburg. The Alaska Redistricting Board yesterday adopted significant changes to Southeast Alaska's political boundaries. Munoz's current Mendenhall Valley district expands to Haines, Skagway, Gustavus, and Frontier Bay. The board also redrew the capital city's other House district, represented by Beth Curtula, to include downtown, Douglas Island, the airport, and Fritz Cove Road. The redistricting board originally paired downtown Juneau with Petersburg. The fishing community argued that it doesn't have enough in common with Juneau, which is more dependent on government and tourism. Thomas says he can now make that argument.
I don't think we have much in common with Juneau, but I guess, you know, other than we're all people, so I guess that's one way to look at it. But if you looked at just Haines, we're primarily, a fishing town, so, you know, I think they're going to be the same dilemma they have in Petersburg.
Thomas currently represents what's known as the Ice Worm District, comprised of native villages and fishing communities all the way to Cordova. Munoz and Thomas, both Republicans, have already filed to run for re-election in districts that look far different than those announced yesterday. They have until June 1st to decide if they will run against each other in the August Republican primary. Munoz believes the redistricting board's latest plan will be challenged by Alaska Native groups.
There's still a lot of uncertainty with this plan because of the elimination with this plan of the Native voting district. I'm not sure what, if anything, will change from this option A that was adopted today and what might eventually come out of the Department of Justice ruling on this plan. But I do anticipate that there will be challenge from Native organizations in our region.
Una and Angoon, previously in Thomas's district, are now with Sitka, Petersburg, and Wrangell, as well as several small towns on Prince of Wales Island and a number of other tiny communities, including Tanaki Springs, Elfin Cove, and Pelican. Under the current plan, the Southern Southeast House District includes Ketchikan, Saxman, Metlakatla, Craig, Klawock, and Heidelberg. Representative Peggy Wilson of Wrangell and Representative Kyle Johansson of Ketchikan, who had previously been expected to run against each other, would no longer be, but Senators Bert Stebman of Sitka and Albert Kukesh of Angoon would still run head-to-head. Redistricting Board Attorney Michael White says challenges to the plan still remain before the state superior court, and the outcome of that issue is still up in the air.
So it could be that this plan is the plan for the rest of the decade. It could be that the board will need to come back and do some more work. We just don't know that yet.
The changes in Southeast voting districts brought up the issue of truncation, which a midterm incumbent must face re-election if substantial changes are made in the voting population within new district boundaries. White says both Stebman and Kukesh are up for election this year anyway, so the truncation issue does not apply to the newest version of Southeast districts.
Other senators, the 10 who are up for election this time, 9 of them are having their terms truncated because their districts have substantially changed. And since it's the people whose rights are being protected here, you say, okay, it's only fair that if a substantial portion of the people who you represent are different, that they should have the ability to go in and elect whom they want to be their candidate. The only term senator who is not up for election in 2012, who's not being truncated, is Senator Egan, because his district is 82-84% the same.
Even if the new plan is approved by the Alaska Supreme Court, it must still pass scrutiny by the U.S. Justice Department. The board's attorney, Mike White, says that process could take 60 days. Southeast Alaska lost population in the last census, and the number of House districts in the region are shrinking from 5 to 4. Leaders in Washington, D.C. are renewing the push to ratify a 30-year-old treaty known as the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. The treaty's passage could pave the way for expanded drilling in the Arctic Ocean, and as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, there's an odd assortment of groups pushing for it in the nation's capital.
Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman John Kerry says he'll hold hearings on the treaty soon. That comes just as Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Martin Dempsey are urging the Senate for ratification. The Law of the Sea, as it's known, has been signed by more than 160 countries. For all intents and purposes, it's a constitution for the ocean, with jurisdiction over piracy, shipping channels, and yes, deep-sea drilling. And because of its wide scope, it has an unlikely list of supporters, from environmentalists to oil and gas companies.
It is a welcome sight to see us holding hands as we move forward on an issue.
That's Robin Rorick. He's with the American Petroleum Institute, the lobbying association for the oil and gas industry. And he's talking about the environmentalists who see a UN treaty as an opportunity to regulate the potentially dirty offshore drilling industry. Rorick says the law of the sea would allow the United States to move further outward, beyond the current drilling restriction of 200 nautical miles off the coast. That means to the deeper and colder deep sea beds of the outer continental shelf. But without the treaty, oil companies are hesitant to do so.
Companies invest billions of dollars to operate offshore. You do not want to invest in an area where there are no rules or regulations, no certainty of operations. We can operate, sure, but it's almost like building a home somewhere where there are no laws, where there's nothing to govern you.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has the task of convincing skeptical Republicans to sign on to the treaty, and she's got a pretty straightforward argument. Every day the United States is not in the Arctic, preparing to tap into vast reserves of oil. Other countries are.
We cannot push back on Russia's claim or Canada's claim or anybody else's if we're not at the table.
Not all in her party seemed poised to join her. Conservatives in the Senate are circulating a letter of opposition. So far, it has more than 24 signatures. Treaties only go through the Senate, and they need 67 votes to pass, so that 25-vote block could prove to be a considerable force. The letter of opposition says the U.S. would sacrifice its sovereignty by signing on. That's an argument echoed by Stephen Groves. He's with the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He says the U.S., as a sovereign nation, has an inherent right to exploit the outer continental shelf. And by signing on to a UN treaty, the country could be forced to share some of its oil royalties with other nations.
Currently, the United States is not exposed to baseless international lawsuits, and currently the United States enjoys the right to explore and exploit deep seabed minerals without asking the permission of the International Seabed Authority.
The sovereignty argument is not new. In fact, it's one you often hear when the U.S. considers joining a United Nations effort. For his part, Senator Begich called opposition to the treaty on sovereignty grounds harebrained.
The problem is you have some members of the Senate that just believe in the conspiracy theory that somehow we're giving up our sovereignty, we'll lose our economic opportunity up there, and somehow people with blue hats will be running the Arctic in our territory.
Those blue hats are the trademark of United Nations peacekeepers across the globe. But if Senators Murkowski and Begich think they can get the magic 67 votes needed for ratification, they'll need to do so quickly. And if there's one indicator that has vote counters feeling optimistic the treaty could pass the Senate, it's just who Shell Oil brought on to lobby for it, Trent Lott. Lott, a former Senate majority leader, opposed the treaty when he was in office. Now, just 5 years later, he's pushing his old colleagues to pass it. To some, that may look like a typical Washington move, leaving office, then having a dollar-induced change of heart. But to others, it's a sign long-held opposition may be falling. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.